Good morning, everyone. Let me first start by thanking the organizers for giving this opportunity to visit KITP. As you can see from the title, there is a change with respect to the scheduled title. I found too many constraints in this conference, so I decided to replace my constraints with suggestions. The talk is organized in three parts, actually two parts and a small little part at the end. For each topic, spiral galaxies and elliptical galaxies, I try to identify what I think are relatively important issues. And at the end I will say, well, let's hope that gravitational lensing will help us in solving these problems. When I was writing this, I was a bit skeptical, but it appears, as you saw from Tommaso's presentation yesterday, that gravitational lensing often provides unexpected power in finding solutions to our problems. In the last part, that I think will be very short, I will switch the roles and I'll try to present a new possible way to produce diagnostics by combining efforts from stellar dynamics and gravitational lensing. About introduction, I would like to mention just a few things. That is, the main goals that we are really trying to work on are the disentangling luminous from dark matter in their distributions. Of course, we would like to know about formation, evolution, the distant universe, and so on. Well, when we come down to the issue of constraints, I see two different approaches to the problem. One is kind of direct diagnostics, where one dreams of finding very neat and hard numbers with very little physics in terms of assumptions. And the other approach is to work on physical mechanisms. That's more natural for one person like myself doing dynamics as a job. So in this sense, the emphasis would be on something else. And of course, the data, the facts, the diagnostics would come in as very important. In general, I would combine things together to say that dynamics of galaxies doesn't matter if you are doing stellar dynamics or planetary nebulae or X-rays or H1. Each little part of the story is part of the dynamics of galaxies. I will mention in my talk a number of things, and of course I will also not mention a number of things. So I will leave out a number of topics that are very important, such as problems related to the Milky Way or central massive black holes and so on. You will see. I apologize in advance because in such a short presentation probably will leave out also a number of names and contributions that would be relevant and important in a review. Like the one I was supposed to give. So eventually we come to the issue, what are the key issues from the dynamics of galaxies that would be interesting in the context of gravitational lensing? So I come to the first part. I first will remind you of some points that come from direct diagnostics, and then I will go through a number of points that come from the study of mechanisms. In terms of diagnostics, I start from the classical work by Van Albada et al. On 3198. The point made at that time, about 20 years ago, was that there is a kind of conspiracy between the contribution of dark and luminous matter in supporting rotation curves in galaxies. The figure here is taken from a paper by Stefano Casertano and Jacqueline Van Gorkum. And already there, the issue of conspiracy was put under scrutiny. That is, there were some criticism in this paper if there was indeed a conspiracy, because in some cases you will see also declining rotation curves. They had two cases where beyond the optical radius there would be evidence for a declining rotation curve. Not Keplerian though, still in need of dark matter. More recent work in this line of research, of course, continues through the contributions from Groningen and collaborators. You have already heard from Bob Swatters, and you will hear later on from this session. One point that is coming out as possibly very interesting is the study of the other end of the distribution of spiral galaxies, that is, those galaxies that are relatively early type and bright, and that indicate that there are declining rotation curves. Declining is also related to the fact that this matches what appears to be the contribution from luminous matter. So here the support from dark halos seems to be not so important. Coming down to the proper issues of dynamics, what I see in terms of outstanding problems in the dynamics of spiral galaxies are spiral structures. And of course, what comes to the eyes is that some objects have definitely a large-scale barred structure, and others don't. Of course, there are cases in between. It's not such a sharp transition. Here, to me, it seems that the simple statement that can be made relating the theories that have been developed now some time ago, especially in referring to the density wave theory, is that if all galaxy disks were embedded in massive dark halos, we would not see barred spiral galaxies. This comes out from the theory, and basically, I could spend hours to go through the mechanisms which I worked on for a number of years. It relates on the properties of the waves that can be carried in the massive disk with respect to those that can be carried in a light disk, light or massive with respect to the bulge halo component. And this goes back, in a sense, as a reversal of the argument that was given by Ostreicher and Peebles in 1973, when dark halos were being discovered. At that time, their argument was, we don't see a bar spiral structure, at least on the large scale, for our own galaxy, then there should be a dark halo that makes the disk of our own galaxy light. That was based on a conjecture, and then the work done later was actually quite detailed. You can study the eigenmodes, the internal nodes of galaxy disks, and indeed, those were computed and studied at length. And you can see here, for example, with little effort in terms, there is no fit of this model to this. It's just I picked one bar mode out of cases that come out generically for massive disks. And just show you an NGC 1300. You will see how natural it comes to in terms of matching the morphology, internal modes. This is like internal note of a violin string. And the dotted circle would be the corrotation circle, the eigenvalue predicted by the theory. And people have measured in bar galaxies where the corrotation circle is. There are some people in the audience have done this type of work. And it matches the expectations of the theory that the corrotation circle would be roughly barely outside the bar. And this goes with the dust lanes and so on. All the theory of spiral structure is very rich. It's not just looking at the bar with respect to something that does not have a bar. You can see the modulation of the spiral arms, the blobs, down the hill, up the hill, and goes neatly also there. Quantitatively speaking, this is taken from an abstract written about 20 years ago, it will be that there is the boundary between disk supporting bar spiral structure and normal spiral structure is given by this number. Of course, this is model dependent. There would be room to do things about that. But the statement, I would say, comes out quite clear-cut as an expectation. And this can also be framed in the broader discussion of morphologies of spiral galaxies, flocculent and non-flocculent, and so on. The heavy disks are expected to have this bar structure. Now, you have heard from Julio Navarro earlier this conference that there are also possible different points of views. For example, one suggestion made, if I interpret it properly, earlier at this conference, that you may have a prolate dark halo, prolate rotating structure. This would drive spiral structure in the disk and also have the bar in it. So it would be very nice to have a measurement here to make a decisive measurement of how things stand. The point is that traditional methods applied to bar galaxies are often controversial because the system is not as axisymmetric as for systems without bar structure. And so here I'm making this hope that maybe, who knows, or possibly with gravitational lensing we will be able to come around this problem. Going to the three-dimensional morphologies of galaxies, there are two important aspects of the problem that can be identified. One refers to warps. It is the disks of spiral galaxies, especially if you, except for that beautiful optical case, if you study them in the radio, in their outer parts, usually present a distortion with respect to the natural planar symmetry. These distortions have been studied from the dynamical point of view in a number of ways. And the halo matter, dark matter, has been very helpful because immediately it was realized, for example, that it can resolve the problem of differential precession of these bent structures of the disk. The long-term persistence of these structures, if you put a dominant spherical halo, is there, and the persistence is difficult to justify if you don't have the halo. This was a point made by Tubbs and Sanders long ago, and then picked up again in a different form, basically in the same with the same idea by Linda Spark and Stefano Casertano. But also, the halo can solve a long-standing problem identified by Hunter and Toomery earlier, that if you study the stability, the vertical stability of a flat disk, self-gravitating disk, there is no way to have instabilities towards bent structures. That is, the disk is stable with respect to bending waves. Halo may help because you can have motion of the disk, fast rotating matter, with respect to the slower rotating halo. And so you have a kind of Kelvin-Helmholtz instability taking place, not necessarily in the hydrodynamical sense. So after those studies that go back to long ago, there have been a good deal of work done more recently. And again, you would see that halo matter, if it is there or it's not there, would make a difference. Other points that are more recently related to the dynamics of galaxy disks refer to the extraplanar cold gas. My conclusion is very simple in a sense, that is, it's obvious that there are these interrelations. What I find it difficult is to make a statement whereby, by a single observation or a set of observations, it would be crucial to something like I stated for the spiral structure, I cannot do here. The theory doesn't make a simple prediction to work on. If I move on to elliptical galaxies, I start again to follow the same ideas, that is, first, what are the basic structural properties of these systems. Now, here I go back to an article written about 15 years ago and pieces of work that were done at that time. At that time, it was very interesting to find that in some objects, like NGC 4472, just on the basis of stellar dynamical data that would be confined to the inner bin of this radial coordinate, If you extrapolated these models out to larger volumes, you will find that the indication for the presence of dark halos was indeed in line with some of the more modern statements made even at this conference. That is, the combined rotation curve will stay flat over an incredible radial range. Note that this was done without the help of all the diagnostics that came more recently. At the same time, different diagnostics in H1 was giving the same indication. This is a beautiful piece of work by Laurent Franks and Van Gorthom and Tim Deseo that came down basically to this data point only. The H1 ring in this galaxy provides just this data point, but this data point is sort of aligned with the flat rotation curve again. Here we are at about 6 REs, so the sampling by H1 is incredibly interesting. And so you can see this conspiracy popping up even in this field. You may argue that this was just an extrapolation. At that time, what was done was to take different options given by the stellar dynamics in terms of amount of dark matter in the halo and try to see what would be the consequent X-ray emission that was available further out as a prediction. So on the basis of a model like this, we would predict the X-ray emission and temperature profile. This was done at the time where the X-ray data were not so accurate as we have now with XMM and especially with Chandra. But you can see with this data from NGC 4636 that the extrapolations could really catch some trends in a natural way, not too much of an effort. This is a summarizing table where at one conference we compared the properties of a big elliptical galaxy such as 4472 with a small spiral galaxy 3198. And these are results from an ESO program with all these authors listed down here. The table is possible to read in a few minutes, but the point was that there was a surprise, that is, in selecting without having the possibility of making strong statistically significant statements, but in selecting a sample of objects reasonably well studied, 3 out of 10 did not show strong evidence for a dark halo. And indeed, the case of 3379 came out as a case where we could do away with without dark matter. This, again, was at a time where most of the data were confined in terms of stellar dynamics to RE. Later on, there has been an enormous progress in sampling the outer parts of elliptical galaxies with the use of techniques that range from the use of planetary nebulae. Magna Naboldi has been especially involved in this, and collaborators that are present in this paper. But not only planetary nebulae, also globular clusters. And I listed here a number of papers related to this. And these studies go in the direction of confirming what I was just mentioning. That is, some galaxies will have a 1 over r square density distribution, total density distribution, and others would be like 3379, apparently or possibly devoid of dark matter. In this business, possibly a major progress will come out from studies like this that find low luminosity H1 disks in around elliptical galaxies. It might well be, as for the extraplanar gas, that if we look hard enough, these H1 disks are ubiquitous. If this is the case, and if they all come out to be as regular as this, we will have a beautiful diagnostics for these systems that will cut all our problems in one shot. But that takes an enormous amount of time to to do well. So, summarizing something about the structure of elliptical galaxies, I tried to make a statement. Here in large ellipticals, there is evidence for moderate halos, and so on and so forth. And you can see that this trend goes on at relatively high Z, as we heard at this conference, from a number of contributions like Rusin, and we will hear from Leon Koopmans, and so on. One issue of dynamics that I find interesting is that these planetary nebulae are also telling us that possibly these dark halos or these structures outside can carry a significant amount of angular momentum. What one sees is significant rotation in the outer parts of these slowly decaying, in terms of density distribution systems. As far to small ellipticals, well, they appear to be rotation supported, and I'm not aware of hard evidence for dark halos in small ellipticals. Intermediate cases, like here listed above, can present some puzzling behavior. I think I'm running late, but not too late. So I will mention, before switching to the third item, some comments about the X-ray diagnostics. I'm not an X-ray person, so don't take it too seriously, in the sense that I see the problem from the side of stellar dynamics mostly. My impression is the following, that is, in the context, in the community of stellar dynamics, I think we had paid great attention to the issue of dark matter, pressure, and isotropy degeneracy. And this has been handled in a number of ways, either with physical arguments or, as Ortwin Gerhard and others have done, in terms of proper diagnostics, the study of line profiles, to check indeed if pressure and isotropy would be significant in these systems or not. Now, if you go into the X-ray community, at least judging from many papers I have read, the trend is, in a sense, to take as undisputed the hydrostatic equilibrium condition. Of course, X-rays are available further out with respect to RE, so they sample larger volumes. The simple statement at the end is that very often it is thought that X-ray diagnostics is much more reliable than stellar dynamics in probing the dark halos in elliptical galaxies. Already at the time when we were checking the extrapolation of our models further out, it became clear that actually the stellar dynamical constraint, using again one of the words that I was mentioning at the beginning of my talk, that stellar dynamical constraint inside RE is very powerful because the data can be very accurate there. And some controversial statements made in the past about the X-ray halos, for example, or NGC 4472, actually came down to inconsistencies that were explained by saying that something could not be realistic because it would violate the constraints. Some conclusions would be not realistic because they would violate the constraints posed by stellar dynamics. If I come down to more recent work, I found possibilities going in different directions. That is, take the case for like M87. There has been a paper by Tsai claiming that an apparent discrepancy, detection of less mass with respect to optical measurements, was possibly related to the improper use of a single phase model for the hot coronal gas. Less mass may result also from application of a hydrostatic equilibrium in the presence of inflows. This has been pointed out by Ciotti and Pellegrini 2 years ago. Something that is more discussed in the context of clusters of galaxies, but might well be present as an issue, as a problem also at the level of elliptical galaxies, are turbulent motions in the hot gas. This might also be a fact, because if there are turbulent motions, you cannot use the thermal pressure in your hydrostatic equilibrium. You have to introduce an effective pressure to do the proper job. A recent, I would say, hot case, even though the X-ray emission from 3379 is very small, hot case of 3379 has been studied, made by a paper by Fukasawa et al. That studied a number of other galaxies. They reported a major apparent discrepancy detection of more mass from X-rays with respect to studies based on stellar dynamics, like the paper on science that I was quoting and previous work. Pellegrini and Ciotti have just published, I think it has just appeared, a paper where they show that the failure of this the discrepancy can be explained in terms of a failure of the hydrostatic equilibrium, because for a small galaxy like this, an outflow condition of hot gas is anticipated, and this would provide an explanation for what goes on. And you can see, I would have other comments to make. Of course, there is a beautiful piece of work that came out recently that I'm showing a picture from that. It's a study of seven galaxies in extremely detailed and accurate way in terms of X-ray data from Chandra. So the final statement here is that great progress will be made by joint diagnostics. I have the feeling that each of these separate diagnostics for this system, for elliptical galaxy, may suffer from limitations. But I'm sure that putting things together, things will come out eventually in a clear-cut way. There is a comment here before I move to the third part. After so many years of studying the so-called dark matter and isotropy degeneracy, my feeling is that it has been rather a nuisance than a problem, in the sense that it appears, at least for the bright ellipticals, that the distribution functions, after all, those that are consistent with the line profiles we see, are relatively regular and consistent with the picture of violent relaxation. That is, the galaxy would be basically isotropic in the inner half of the in its inner half, and mildly radially anisotropic in the outer parts. So what is the issue that I would identify for the topic of elliptical galaxies? Well, I think what we are left is what seemed to be a simple dynamical situation. That is, those low luminosity ellipticals that are rotation supported and seem to be so natural in terms of their internal dynamics, nowadays, I would like to know better about them, and, for example, if they are embedded in dark, massive dark halos or not. And all this has been lost. I mean, we are focused a lot on bright elliptical galaxies, and I think our understanding of low luminosity elliptical galaxies has not made much progress as would have been desirable. There would be had been a comment on dynamical evolution that I will skip because I only have 2 minutes to go to part three. Part three is completely different. It's a simple idea that was prepared especially for this conference. That is an application of combining the efforts of stellar dynamics and gravitational lensing. Refer to the fundamental plane as a standard rod, which is something that is even taught in class as a topic. Then, as a standard rod, if it is put behind the gravitational lens, it will be magnified. And the magnification is provided by this term. I used the determinant of the ray tracing matrix, so I could have written square root of mu, or I don't know what is the standard notation in gravitational lensing. So if we knew, or if we measured all the other terms, the formula upstairs is a formula derived in the limit of small kappa, but of course the magnification is there and can be measured even when, and better if the lens that you are considering is stronger. Well, for the limit of small kappa, you will see what is the relation. That is, the magnification that you would see in terms of the effective radius that is measured to be larger than what should be there, intrinsically speaking, that magnification can be translated into a measurement of kappa, provided we knew all the other terms, like, for example, gamma as a function of z. The scatter in the fundamental plane, even at z around up to 1 or almost to 1, is very small. And this, last minute, that's enough, this is actually, gives us the possibility of making an accurate measurement of kappa in one shot. The method immediately breaks the Marshy degeneracy, and I think would be very interesting for this, because previous attempts at measuring a magnification were definitely more difficult to carry out. And in addition, this method would also, with a single galaxy, able to provide a single measurement of the density of a cluster on pencil beams that are about the order 1 arcsecond or a bit more, the size of the galaxy behind the cluster. Ideas of this type can be applied to Tully-Fisher relation, but the Tully-Fisher relation, at least as far as we know at this point so far, is not so well established. Is not so well established at large distances. The other point is that the trend gamma of z appears to be well determined, as from the work of Tommaso Treu and others in recent times. This summarizes the expectations, and pretty on time, just 1 minute left. The expectation on a sample of objects done under realistic conditions. You will see that the offset can be major, and this expectation was carried out in a simulation run by Marco Lombardi with realistic properties. Maybe not perfect as a case, but gives you the idea that the effect is really a major one that we are expecting. So, conclusions of part one. In spite of what has been learned and can be stated, I think some important general issues in relation to the structure of galaxies, the origin of bar spiral structure, the basic state of low luminosity ellipticals, depend on a decisive measurement about the relative distribution of dark and luminous matter that traditional diagnostics have so far been unable to make. And here I hope that something will come out soon. Conclusions, part two. A simple idea based on the joint use of dynamics and lensing is proposed, hopefully with interesting diagnostic potential. Sorry for being 2 minutes late.
Hi, I think it's a very important constraint of the work you've done and others on bars, and I'd like to ask you what your feeling is from the disk dynamical perspective, what the implication of that is for low surface brightness in dwarf galaxies. I mean, just from the rotation curve, we imply that those things are inverted, that those things are very dark matter dominated, and you'd think that would, I would think anyway, that would suppress the bar modes. And you don't see a lot of really strong thin bars, but you do see an awful lot of sort of lumpy, you know, bar-like things. And I just wonder what that means to you.
Well, the case of low surface brightness should be studied, as you mentioned, in better detail. What I was referring in my talk was especially the case of standard high brightness object. In terms of relative amounts of dark and luminous matter in low surface brightness, there remains, I think, some options, that is, you can have a relatively massive disk with a high M over L ratio, and so the arguments I was providing would point into that direction, but it would be nice to have a clear-cut determination of how things are. So that's an open problem that you correctly pointed out.
There was a recent paper by Dekel et al. That arguing in the cases where you see a falling velocity dispersion curve in ellipticals, it's the result of the outer parts of the galaxy being on radial orbits, and that this is expected based on simulations. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, probably the person who would like to comment on this is Ortwin Gerhardt or Magda Gnamoldi. My personal feeling is that we had to check well the numbers, because the amount of radial pressure that you need, the radial anisotropy that you need to do a significant change in the balance between presence or not presence of dark matter, you need really a lot of radial pressure. So the simulations, of course, if they point out to this possibility, they are to be taken into account. And by combining all these things, concluding the X-ray data, I think the answer will come out. And I don't want to give it now myself. I didn't do the work. So I don't know if Ortwin has to add anything.
Perhaps only that these simulations do indicate radial anisotropy, but of course, a long standard topic in principle without including the study of radial anisotropy.
Yes. Yeah.
So it can be determined in detail the simulations are not a good one.
Yeah.
Concerning the case of 3379, we are in the Sauron team of putting an IFU at 3 to 5 factor radii, and the first results, although not published, it's pretty hard to get the dispersions there, seems to indicate that it is flat, so that there is no decrease in velocity dispersion. And if I remember correctly, maybe it's not true, but originally the planetary nebula were clear decrease, but when the global cluster data came around, it was already pointing towards at least a much less decrease in the velocity dispersion profile. And one other comment, I think it's also important in modeling to consider not only the velocity anisotropy, but also the geometry, since all of the models are still being done are spherical models, and this of course has also an
important impact. How wide is the field of the IFU data? That does it cover the entire?
We use it as, in principle, in terms of use of IFU, but we can't. We use all the different apertures. We count it as one aperture just to increase the same for noise.
No, but I was saying, in terms of RE, how far out do you go?
With three. We have pointed at 3 and 5 RE.
A comment in this, as a, not an answer, but a comment in reaction to your point, is that at the time that I mentioned many years ago, and even more recently to some extent, there would be some room for different options, like a diffuse dark halo would be there if it is sufficiently spread out and things like that. But we have to check the numbers.
So to follow on from Glenn's point, of course the globular clusters have a higher velocity dispersion than the planetaries, but they're also more extended spatially. Since they're all sitting in the same potential, it's actually completely consistent. The mass model that you get from both populations is the same, but the velocity dispersion is of course different because they're different orbit time.
Yeah, there you have to argue again about whether the globular cluster population is a fair sample of the stellar dynamics of the galaxy itself, because if you put it, for example, the globular cluster on circular orbits, as sometimes it was argued to be the case because of dynamical friction, then you would have a naturally flatter dispersion profile. But I think all these issues are partly understood and partly to be cleared by further analysis.
But can I ask you a question about the disk to halo ratios in the first part of your talk?
Yes.
There's a number of issues which I think are still outstanding, such as spiral structure at very large radii, which
yes.
don't fit with any of these ideas of halo suppressing instabilities.
Why do you say so?
Well, many galaxies in the part where yeah. any mass model would give you a very strong dark matter domination
yeah.
still show quite strong spiral structure in the place where...
Well, that's welcome. I mean, I've always been happy to hear about spiral arms further out, because if you study the mechanisms, you have that these structures transport angular momentum outwards. And you see these structures in the gas. And the gas does not feel the outer limbular resonance. So to me, those are just the signals popping out in the galaxy, sent out like on beach waves that become prominent because you have very little inertia there. So I think those are do not contradict any of the points that it was stating. The inner galaxy is the source of the internal instability. Then if you see something outside, yeah.
Data now, you know, rules out an isothermal or logarithmic potential beyond, say, an effective radii or not. And can we answer that question, or are we still in the
theories?
I think it's complicated because I think Glenn's point is correct. But in principle, you can make a system in which the velocity curve in the case of radius any way you want by changing the flattening grades along the line of sight. So as long as one galaxy is fairly model in transition. So if you have many of them, then that information will not hold. Within the spherical model, the velocity curve is completely consistent with an isotropic Keplerian, luminous mass only, therefore a dark red Keplerian and all of that is very large. That doesn't mean that it has to be that.